Well, my name's Jerry Parker, and I got started in the profession really by accident, and it's as simple as that. I'd always wanted to do some form of journalism, whether it be broadcasting or writing and so forth, but at school, nobody picked up the fact that I suffered from dyslexia. The net result was that I left school without passing any single exams, and in those days, if you didn't have a piece of paper to wave around to say that you could do things, then you couldn't do them. It was as simple as that. So I spent the best part of 20 years in business, reasonably successful, I suppose, which was a mixture of the fruit and veg business and in horse racing. And suddenly, because of a hobby, one night of amateur theatre, I met a man who was worked for the BBC, though I didn't realise it at the time. And he asked me to come up to visit him one day in Tindall's Park Road, in what looked like a building site. And I thought he wanted some flowers, quite honestly, for his wife or somebody else. And he said, we're opening local radio here. And I said, when? He said, 10 days' time. And I laughed, because I thought, there's no way you were opening anything here in 10 days' time, quite honestly. And he said, we've been talking, you know a great deal about horse racing. Would you care to talk to our sports editor and give him some contacts so that he can get information about horse racing? And I did. And after we'd been talking for a while, the sports editor said to me, well, I think that's too complicated. You wouldn't like to sort of take on the job of doing that for us. And so I took a voice test straight away and, very excited, went home to my wife to say that I was now the horse race correspondent of BBC Radio Bristol, which didn't mean very much, quite honestly. But the day it opened, we had a preview program. And you've heard the expression of somebody going, literally going white before your face. And this is what happened to the sports editor, because we started the program live, and he said to me, right, I went in while there was tape being played. We sat on a round table, and I had to do a 2-minute preview of Bath races. And he said, where's your script? And I said, pardon? And he said, where's your script? And I said, I haven't got one. And he said, well, what have you got? And I had some notes written in the margin of Sporting Life. And here am I, never having broadcast in my life, in front of him, about to do a 2-minute preview without anything in front of me, which absolutely frightened him to death. But of course, I'd learnt it in my head. This is the only way I could do it, quite honestly, rather than sight read. And so that went off well. And that was the beginning of it, quite honestly. It was a wonderful time in Radio Bristol, because you were starting from scratch. You had no lines to say you've got to work within this period or not. You made programmes, you had to be the producer, you had to be the presenter, you had to be the researcher, and it was a very thrilling and exciting time. You also only had a handful of listeners, so if you made a mistake, not many people heard you.
Yeah, I think that you probably agree there have been changes. Can you tell us about the way things used to work back when you first started at Radio Bristol?
Well, I think there's been enormous changes. I mean, for instance, you know, you now have this playlist where you have music which is there, and you have to play it off the playlist which is chosen for you. And they say it gives the actual station an identity, because that's the style of music they're going to have. You chose all your own music. So if you were doing the afternoon show, as I did sometimes, and you had guests coming in, you chose the music that you thought would go with the guests. You chose the music that thought would go with your personality. And so the whole program revolved around those two things. No, it doesn't. You've got to fit into this pattern that makes sure that when people switch on, this is the idea, I'm told, that they know it's Radio Bristol or it's whatever station they're listening to. Not so then. You could really let your own personality get involved in the show. I mean, all right, I'm old-fashioned in that sense. I think it's a pity, but nevertheless, that's where the big change came.
Do you think that there's any sort of professional aspect to that? I mean, as regards music and other things that producers have to deal with, do you think it's actually a professional issue or not?
I think it's a professional issue in the sense that I don't think the person who's actually now presenting or producing the show quite has the freedom that they once had. You know, you could go down more or less the lines that you were going. I know you had your boss above you listen to you and came in and told you, you know, you'd made a terrible error or so forth. But having said that, at least you had the initial chance to make your own feelings felt on the air. You could also do enormous difficulties. Like me, I got in terrible trouble once by presenting a record which should never have been played, called The Sun Has Got His Hat On. Now, that sounds innocuous enough, doesn't it? And I played this, and I sent to London with a copy of Henry Hall and the BBC Dance Orchestra playing The Sun Has Got His Hat On. Fine, and duly tried it for level and played it. What I didn't know was that it was recorded in the early 1930s, and the original line in there is something which now is completely and utterly politically incorrect. The line being, you know, was he's been chasing niggers down in Timbuktu, which was hardly the thing to put on. I didn't realise it was there, quite honestly, and of course it's now part of the show Me and My Girl, and it's been changed, as you can imagine. I think it's he's been roasting peanuts down in Timbuktu nowadays. We had a lot of complaints, but not as many as you would think, and strangely, very, very few of them, in fact only, I think I'm right in saying, about three, from the black community. The majority of them came from other groups within the city who were very much more politically correct.
Okay, so you did a stint at Radio Bristol. How did that come to end, and then what did you subsequently do?
Before it came to an end, I started writing for the Western Daily Press. And that came about because the Western Daily Press weren't very keen to spend too much money on horse racing, information about horse racing, and the BBC Radio Bristol had no money. And what we had was that there was a wonderful man at the time who was a sports editor called Herbert Gillam. Herbie Gillam was a real old-fashioned journalist who had come up, you know, learnt the job from carrying bits of copy around the office and so forth. And he ran a very good sports section in the Western Daily Press. But for his racing, he kept telling me that he had nothing local coming his way. So there might be a meeting at Bath or Chepstow. And because his copy came down from the Press Association, they might be featuring York races, for argument's sake. So we were talking in those veins. But at the same time, there were no mobile phones, remember. And so if you didn't have a landline and you were trying to report a football match, by this time, by the way, I was sports editor at Radio Bristol. You had a job, you had to hire somebody who had a line from the football ground. Herbie, of course, because he reported all the away games for the Western Daily Press, had this line. So we came to an agreement that I would do his racing and he would do my away football, and we wouldn't pay one another. And that's really how I drifted into, like, into the writing side of journalism.
What about the union? When did you first get involved with the union, and why?
To begin with, I'll be quite honest with you, self-preservation. I say that because when I started the BBC, one of the first people I worked with was a man called Don Moss. And Don had been one of the original disc jockeys on Radio Caroline. And we were talking one day, and then the manager as well, David Wayne, said to me, you know, we've got to have union members. As far as Radio Bristol were concerned at the time, they wanted people to be members of a union. And there were several unions one we could go into. I wasn't very keen on the broadcasting unions. And because I was interested in journalism as such, I discovered that as a presenter, I could join the National Union of Journalists. And so that originally, if you like, purely out of self-preservation is what I did. But having done so, I found it, you know, it was a very good thing to have that umbrella behind you. I think over the years, it's probably, it'd be fair to say that it had no longer, like a lot of unions, has the clout that it had in those days.
What clout did it have in those days?
Well, I think it had the clout that if there was any problem that you had behind you, you felt that you had somewhere with real strength that could come in behind you and say, I will support this person, and you could go to them, argue your case. I mean, not always, but sometimes your case didn't hold water, and naturally enough, they wouldn't support you, but in the majority of cases, they would. And to have the feeling that you had that sort of backup, and that nobody was going to walk all over you, as any big organisation, like the BBC, or for that matter, the old Bristol United Press, as they were, to feel that you had that backing behind you, gave you a great deal of strength, and gave you also the strength to say, well, I am going to go out on a limb and go down this line and make a big issue out of this, because you felt you had some backing behind you to do it.
What about the early days at the BBC here in Bristol, and and the union. Can you remember any disputes or incidents?
Yes, and not to my credit in some ways, if you like, because on one occasion I actually stopped BBC Radio Bristol supporting a strike at Radio Sheffield, I think it was. And it wasn't deliberately in a way, but there was not, I'll be confess with you, there was not a great interest in the union within the BBC. Most of them belonged to different unions, as I say, within the corporation. And there was a dispute over a man who'd been sacked at Radio Sheffield. I had heard about this from different people, and quite honestly, I couldn't find any reason why he shouldn't be sacked. That was a personal view, and the more I read it. But one night, the NUJ in Radio Bristol called a meeting, and we arrived and had our meeting. And at this stage, the majority said that we would walk out and support the meeting at the fellow at Sheffield. At which stage I pointed out that there were only actually three of us present. And since there were only three of us present, and I constituted a third of the meeting, that we couldn't really say that we would support him, because that wasn't a big enough majority. And that was unkind, wasn't it? But I thought, well, I'm entitled to stand my guns that way, just as I would in the opposite direction, quite honestly.
Okay, so after your move into print journalism, what were the big differences and the changes that you found from doing broadcasting?
Well, the biggest change, I think, came into the fact that it wasn't so instant. I'd been used to, most of my time in broadcasting, I'd been doing live programmes, for instance. You know, you'd had a three-hour programme on a Saturday afternoon in which all the sports came in, and fronting that, you thought on your feet and so forth. Suddenly, you had the luxury, if you like, of being able to sit down and think out in greater detail what you were going to do. And there were two aspects of this at the same time. Not only the horse racing, which I had written that by that time for some 10 years, but also the theatre, which was my other great love and which I had drifted into doing reviews and articles on different celebrities who came down here. But both of those things, you had that little extra luxury. I know not sometimes when you're up against a deadline, you haven't got a luxury. But those in the main were fewer than I'd been used to in broadcasting.
And what about union activity in the papers? Was there much when you first arrived? Or?
No, I arrived, if you like, towards the end of the great era in that sense. Around the period that I ceased to regularly broadcast, you were coming to the period when the union's power was beginning to wane within the paper. And so where at one time, if you say in 1970, for instance, when I first joined, they did have an enormous clout, I did feel by then that that was on the wane. Again, it was a pity because there were big changes taking place, serious changes taking place. Yet somehow or another, we had lost that great basis that we had earlier on, and it was needed at that time. I think a lot of changes that took place in newspaper industry at that time, some of them necessary because television had eroded a lot of, you know, their previous the previous people who had been interested in newspapers. But nevertheless, we at an important period, we hit a low spot.
What about all the changes in technology as well? I mean, I imagine you've seen them and how it has affected deadlines and things like that. What do you make of all those changes? Because I think although it's fair to say, although there's a lot of the new technology has been positive in many ways, maybe it's been a step backwards in some as well. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, it seems strange to me. You see, I mean, I'm not a technical person. But having said that, it is wonderful. I mean, you know, the technology that we've got now at a fingertip is a completely different world. And it's a wonderful world, and it opens up so many opportunities. And yet deadlines, in many ways, have gone the opposite direction. I'll give you an example. I have done, for the last, well, nearly 30 years now, done racing selections for the Western Daily Press. Excuse me. And during that period, when I first started doing them, I would phone my selections in at night, and as long as I got them in by 7:30, that was fine. Nowadays, if they're past 4:30 at night, there's a scream down the phone as to say, where the hell are they? We need them. And with the modern technology, I sometimes blink and think, hey, man, hang on, you know, we used to sort of do this by hand, and I could do it 3 hours later. So what happened?
What do you put that down to? Because that is a bit mysterious, isn't it? Both for, I think, for journalists and the public, as to why it would be that with all this new technology, that the deadlines have actually moved forward rather than back. I mean, of course, the other thing is that we used to have the stop press, where reporters would wire in important copy or telephone it in very, very late at night while the presses were actually rolling.
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't know enough about the technical reasons for it, but I know that, you know, papers go to bed earlier than they used to, obviously. But why they should, when you've got all that technology, is it because, for instance, you know, so much more that the printers are now used to print more than just the paper? I mean, at one time, the newspaper had its own print machine, and that was it, and nothing else got printed on it. Perhaps it is that you're trying to get, you know, a quart in a pint pot, and by so you are pushing things, condensing things more and more. But I don't know enough about the technical side to really argue the point, quite honestly.
Could you also tell us about some of the any sort of memorable incidents or memorable stories that you've covered during your career?
Well, one of the things that I remember very strongly was the fact that I think I can claim to be the first journalist to be thrown out of Glastonbury. I went to the very first Glastonbury Festival, and in those days it was very strongly motivated politically, and CND, of course, was a very important part of it. And I'd been sent down and was asked particularly if I could get an interview with Arabella Churchill, who was Winston Churchill's granddaughter, who was very much involved with that original festival down there. And, of course, it was wonderful. You just parked in the village and walked through into the field. It was free, and there was nobody to stop you and so forth. And I made my way up to the house where they were organising everything, got in there and managed to get an interview with Arabella Churchill, and was going fine. But I then blotted my copybook by asking too many pertinent questions, I think, and two gentlemen decided that they...
What sort of questions? Come on.
Well, I think mainly because I was trying to tie up the fact of what was Churchill's granddaughter doing, shouting the odds about CND and that side of politics. And she seemed to me that in many ways that she was very keen to be seen to be doing this, but when you tried to nail her down, I couldn't nail her down to actually telling me why she was doing it, or was it just natural rebellion against the previous generation? I don't know. But when I got onto that tack, that was enough, and I was escorted back to the farm gates and suggested that I left right away.
Fascinating. So anything else sort of more urban or something to do particularly with your fascinating career doing theatre reviews, maybe?
Well, the theatre reviews, the only thing I find there is that something that every journalist will have sympathy with, and is the fact that you send your copy in and you don't have the final say as to what it looks like when it gets onto the page. And over the years, there have been many occasions when I've read it and thought, hang about, I didn't write that, and that's not what I wanted to say about this. And I think it was one poor gentleman once that had the worst end of this. I went to see a production of Jesus Christ Superstar, and the fellow playing Jesus was desperately nervous, and you could see he was nervous, and he was terribly tense and uptight. After the interval, whether he had a few drinks or whether somebody talked to him, I don't know, but he relaxed and it was very different. So I said that he was very mechanical during the first half, but fortunately, and this wasn't meant as a pun, he got into the spirit of it in the second half and he relaxed and the whole thing was better. For some reason, the sub decided that I couldn't have that much room, cut it after the butt, and then put as a headline, Mechanical Christ, which said about the opposite of what I was saying about this poor man. And it's one of the few occasions when I actually spent the next couple of hours when I read it, finding where the director was so that he could go round and say to this lad, look, this is what he said about you, not this, and I apologise for it.
So how close does that sort of thing come to censorship, do you think?
I don't think it comes near censorship, because it's invariably done by a sub who hasn't got any agenda of his own. It's just he's in a hurry, or she's in a hurry, and they very often, unfortunately, whereas perhaps in the good days when there were lots more people in the newspaper, they pay off to people who don't know theatre, not interested in theatre, and so they merely wish to take out so many words, cut it down to a certain size, haven't got the luxury or don't want to give you phone you up and ask you whether you can do it, but they will, not deliberately, I think, but they will by accident wind up changing the whole idea of what you've written there. And that, I mean, of course, that's annoying, but then you ask any journalist who's ever written a review that it ever happened to him, and of course it's happened to him over and over again.
There's lots of young people in the profession nowadays for all sorts of reasons. Often it's something as simple as that it's cheaper to employ young people. What advice have you got as someone that's been working in the business for a good many years for those youngsters on their first day on the newspaper or in the broadcasting, you know, doing journalism?
Well, one thing I'd say is something which at one time, you see, you had proofreaders, and they read things through, and so if the grammar was wrong, if the spelling was wrong, if the letter, they would correct it and so forth. You don't have those now, they go straight through. But for me, the whole thing is about communication, and communication goes back to language. We have a wonderful language in this country. I don't want people to still write, you know, airy-fairily and write as though they're doing a great discourse for a university degree. At the same time, I think if you've got to learn the nuts and bolts of what will come off the paper and attract somebody immediately. So you've got to have something, first of all, that grabs them. And for me, you've got to learn those nuts and bolts. So whether or not you are happy, you know, to use slang expressions and so forth, fine. But remember, the person out there has got to immediately be able to pick up on what you've written, understand it, and then think, this is interesting, I want to read on from here. And if you haven't got those nuts and bolts, I don't think you're going to do that.